Good morning and welcome to the July 15, 2019 meeting of the Chelan County PUD Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for coming, and a reminder, please silence any electronic devices you may have brought with you today. Today's meeting is both a study and a business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 o'clock, and the afternoon business session will start around 1 o'clock. We welcome public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone, please state your name, address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have all five commissioners present, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board. So at this time, would you please join us in the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety presentation by Jeremy Jordan.
Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you, commissioners. As you know, we've been going through our three sessions of HPI, and I think we've saved the best for last. This is one of the most interesting concepts to me as we're trying to help folks think about how to protect our safety, our production, and our quality. And it's this idea of drift. As a quick reminder for you, in the last three sessions, we've talked about our five HPI principles, and we've told our employees that our goal here is to give them a roadmap. This is the culture that we want to build together as a district in incorporating HPI. And on the right, you'll see our five HPI concepts. And what we're arguing here is that these five ideas, if we begin to talk about them, if we master them as employees, if we apply them to how we plan, we execute, and learn from our work, that we'll undergo that transformation, and that in a few years, we can be unrecognizable as an organization in how we protect, again, our production, our quality, and our safety. Why we've picked those five concepts as a team is we've seen in lots and lots of these human-caused events throughout history that there are really four major ingredients that we're trying to protect against. Those include this idea that what used to be unusual or concerning to us quickly becomes the norm in terms of safety and production, that we get used to hazards, and they become things that we no longer see. This is drift, and what we want to protect against by teaching that concept. The second major ingredient, that we stop recognizing the warning signs. We don't understand anymore that we can make up to 7 errors an hour, and those things catch us by surprise. Third major ingredient that we're guarding against, this idea that production pressure leads us to overvalue outcomes and ignore process. This is the classic get or done mentality. And the idea that we worry about delivering at a deadline and not necessarily worry about how do we get there safely and what are we doing to make sure that we can replicate that success. And then the last key ingredient that we see in events across history and across cultures is this idea that when people start recognizing these warning signs, they either don't speak up in enough numbers, or when they do speak up, they aren't listened to. And so again, our five concepts are really about guarding against these four key ingredients. So the idea of drift, this new concept that we're going over in July, is the idea that we create these norms, we create these procedures, these rules, these practices as managers. It's what the science calls work as planned or work as imagined. And then we hand those procedures off to our workers, and they go out and they encounter reality. And what they encounter in reality is that those procedures, those norms, those practices don't always work. And so they have to make modifications to deliver their work. So the black line is what is represented by those norms that we plan for, the old norms. The blue line is what we ask our employees to do. And when they're out in the field, they're making changes. Maybe they have a procedure that's great up until the fourth step, and that step no longer works, and they have to come up with a new one on the fly. Maybe it's a policy that says you should do these six things, and two of those things are impossible given that day's work. And so they become what we call masters of the blue line, folks who modify procedures, processes, and practices to get the work done. And that works really well as an organization, and every organization in the world does this. We reward our workers for getting those things done. Right up until that point, that blue line begins to drift down towards the red one. And the red line are the threats that we're protecting against originally when we put procedures in place. And again, because we get comfortable with risk, we stop seeing those red lines until they catch us by surprise and somebody gets hurt or killed.
So I have a question related to the blue line. once a skilled employee creates that blue line, does that become part of institutional memory?
It does. That's okay. A great observation. So when we've done something 20 times in a row and we've been successful at it, we stop seeing the risk and we start seeing the success.
Okay.
And to your point, it does become institutionalized often.
Okay. Unless so that becomes the new black line until innovation would cause us to approach that differently.
And we're going to talk, Commissioner, about three defenses for this.
Okay.
It's back to that black line and to recognize the risk. But you've got a really astute observation.
All right.
This becomes the new standard, for sure.
Okay, thanks. It helps me understand the slide. I thought I understood it, but your explanation was much better than mine.
What I'd like to take you through is a really famous case study. But it's famous for the wrong reasons. A lot of people think they understand why the Exxon Valdez happened. And the cause that most people are familiar with is that there was a captain who was drinking who made bad decisions. He was definitely a big part of this story, but what I'd like to take you through are some examples of how drift started 40 years before the Exxon Valdez was ever built. And that drift that occurred over four decades led to that event in much bigger ways than necessarily just one captain's decisions. Some of the results, if you have not read about the story recently, 11 million gallons of oil spilled in Prince William Sound, 1,300 miles of coastline destroyed, over $4 billion spent in the initial cleanup alone. And a lot of that oil is still washing up on the shores even today, decades later. So the destruction has continued. All of that happened because about 5 minutes of indecision. And again, I'm going to argue about 50 years of drift. I'm not going to take you through the full case study, by the way. I'd encourage you, if you'd like to learn even more, we're going to go through about 30 minutes of this in our training this month. But I'm going to give you about five. And what I'd like to talk with you about is some of the things that shaped up as far as drift-wise before the event ever happened. So in 1955, the first double-bottom tanker was built. And double-bottom tankers were a defense against spills. So a single-bottom tanker, there's about an inch and a half of steel between the oil and the ocean. And so if you have a crash, oil is going to spill out almost always. The double-bottom tanker's innovation was it puts about 10 feet of space between the outer hull and where the oil is stored. And so if you have a crash, that oil is very unlikely to spill. In 1973, two Coast Guard studies found that these would have prevented 27 of 30 major spills in the United States alone. 3 million gallons of oil wouldn't have spilled in the 4 years before that had they used double bottom holes. In 1977, Alaska established Prince William Sound's Vessel Transport Center. This is the organization that oversaw all tanker transport in the state. And they established two shipping lanes, an inbound and outbound from the ocean, tankers to use. This is going to become very important in our story a little bit later. In 1980, we see the first drift, the first major amount of drift, just 3 years later. So the state required state-sponsored pilots to oversee these ships both to and from Valdez Terminal. And in 1980, a major storm knocked out the station at a place called Port Hinchinbrook, where they got on and off the tankers. And so rather than rebuilding that station, the state of Alaska decided to move it inland a little bit further. Give you an example on the map here. Cape Hinchinbrook is down in the lower right. That used to be where the state pilots got on and off the tankers, and that was basically in open water. They moved it much further inland to the second red circle at a place called Rocky Point. And this becomes really significant later because the blue diamond is where the Exxon Valdez grounded, and the state pilot had left the ship by the time that accident happened. So we see the first point where this event could have been prevented had they not drifted away from their original standard. 1984, another bit of drift. So a glacier has been breaking down near the shipping lanes for a number of years, but nobody had anticipated that it would start speeding up. In 1984, the glacier is breaking down so rapidly that it is now filling the outboard shipping lane with icebergs. Captains have two choices. They can either slow way down and slowly brush that ice out of the way, or they can go outside of both lanes into an area where there's no ice. The problem is that outside area takes them within a quarter mile of a place called Bly Reef. And this reef is where the Exxon Valdez eventually founders. 1984, the eventual captain of the Valdez loses his driver's license for drinking for the first time, and he enters treatment. 1986, the commanding officer of the Coast Guard VTC requests radar upgrades. They discover just 6 years into the decade that they're losing many of their tankers on radar and they can't even see them. And so they're dependent on the tankers to tell them where they are. His request is denied because of funding. And And so they get very used to the idea that they're going to lose tankers on a regular basis and just have to continue to communicate with them. So again, we see drift in action. And this year, the Valdez is commissioned as a single bottom tanker. So they ignore 30 years of history and decide that they're going to save a little money. And that because of all the protections in place, that they're okay with that risk. The captain, who is not yet the captain of Valdez, is rated in the bottom 25% of all captains for Exxon. And the final thing that happens in 86 is that the state loosens the requirement that tanker traffic only happen during daylight hours. So that was the original standard. They've drifted away from that and said, you know what, we trust you. You can do this at nighttime too if you like. 1987, the Valdez receives its first of two fleet safety awards. They update the Alaska spill plan. And one of the assumptions they make in the spill plan for Prince William Sound is that a very large spill is so unlikely that they really don't have to plan for it. It becomes kind of just an incidental plan in case it ever happens. The VTC reduces the number of officers overseeing tanker traffic from 5 officers down to 1, again, because of manning requirements. They don't have enough officers, and so rather than fix that problem, they say, you know what, we'll just deal with one person instead.
What's VTC?
That's the Vessel Transport Center for the Coast Guard that oversees all that traffic. The third mate, who eventually makes the critical errors on the Exxon Valdez, and this year is rated in his performance plan as someone who's very uncomfortable in keeping his superiors posted on problems and assigned tasks. When the Exxon Valdez grounds itself, they discover that he is in the middle of a navigation error that he doesn't tell anybody about. So this finding 2 years earlier becomes really critical. Nobody pays attention. Finally, the VTC watch standers, the folks who see all this tanker traffic and oversee it, are told that they no longer have to plot tankers physically on maps, but that they should just monitor them. But nobody at the center tells them what this means. So they've drifted it away from a standard of requiring this down to just keep an eye on it. Last 2 years, in 1988, Prince William Sound VTC manual is updated, and they make the tanker ice procedures now suggested, no longer mandatory, to give captains a lot more flexibility in how they navigate the sound. The helmsman, the person who's steering the Exxon Valdez when it crashes, is rated in his performance plan as someone who steers well under a pilot's orders, but he's not yet at this time to become a helmsman on his own. In just a year, he'll be steering the ship all by himself. A National Institute of Health study digs deep in 1988 into all man-made disasters, and they find one of the most critical elements of all man-made disasters is sleep deprivation. In the crash of the Exxon Valdez, they'll find that over half the crew had worked 18 hours before the crash, with as little as 3 to 4 hours of sleep in that 18-hour period. In 88, Captain Hazelwood loses his driver's license again for drinking. Exxon creates an agreement with him that says they will be overseeing him every 4 weeks and checking in on his status and his treatment. After the crash, they discover that nobody ever followed up with him, and so he was on his own making decisions about his alcoholism without any oversight. Last two things. In 1989, 8,700 successful spill-free tanker trips have happened through Prince William Sound. Everyone has gotten to the point really comfortable, and they can't imagine that any kind of issue is ever going to happen. Unfortunately, in the VTC, the radar regularly now loses tankers as a rule rather than as an exception, and they are often flying blind through all these ice flows and through what is now often really terrible nighttime weather. Point I want to make here, we had one drunk captain. But as you can see, there are 40 years of drift happening in a lot of different organizations that made this event that at one time seem impossible almost inevitable. In our training, we're going to walk through a whole bunch more elements that I'm just going to quickly go through so you can see that added up in the day of that event, a whole bunch more drift. The point I want to get to there here at the end of my presentation is, how do we guard against this? What are our defenses? And as you can see, there was a ton that happened that day. I'm going to argue that there are three defenses for drift as an organization, and this is the first one. We put norms, procedures, and practices in place. We have to ensure that the people who are protected from risk understand what they're being protected from and that they believe it. What we found in the Exxon Valdez and many human-caused events is people get away from understanding what they're being protected from, or they don't even see it anymore, and therefore they stop following the rules. The second, that the employees that we're asking to be protected from those procedures help own them by either writing them or updating them on a regular basis to be safe. And then finally, everyone at every level continually monitors those procedures, those processes, those norms, and they improve them when they start to drift away from what they were originally protecting from. We're going to argue that if any one of these three things are missing, once again, drift is almost assuredly going to happen in a human organization, and people are going to be at risk, as we saw in the Exxon Valdez and we see in many different events. So final conclusion here, again, 50 years of drift led up to this 5 minutes that led to a huge event that we didn't want to happen. These are our defenses. Really appreciate your time today. Take any questions that you have. I know that was kind of a whirlwind.
It was a powerful presentation in my eyes.
It was. I thoroughly enjoyed going through it, and the logic of the presentation really made sense. So how do you deal with the concept of, and you're referring to it here, you know, and maybe I just missed it, but the when something becomes extinguished because of the lack of acuity, it no longer is in the bite of the lion. We've become accustomed to the bite of the lion, so it becomes extinguished. We no longer hear the dog barking in the neighborhood because the dog in the neighborhood barks all the time. And so when you start taking a look at, you know, guarded by the norm, you know, and helping design it, but how do you prevent 40 years of drift? You know, so what's built in that rejuvenates the sense of acuity and the appropriate response to it?
It's a really great question. So we're covering drift last because we believe that the other concepts you have to build on top of to protect against it.
Okay.
So one of the things that we've talked to employees a lot about in the last 2 months is this idea that we have critical steps, these points of no return in our work where if we make a mistake, it could have consequences that we cannot handle. Someone gets hurt or killed, a production item gets destroyed. And so one of the things we've asked employees to start thinking about is, what are your critical steps? What are the things that you approach every day that you've gotten comfortable with? But you recognize now, if you make a mistake here, it could have consequences that we can't handle. I think the other defense that we're asking folks to think about, too, is this idea that as human beings, all of us make up the 7 errors an hour that we can't control for. And that if that error happens in a point that's really critical, once again, we're going to be in a place with no defenses. So I'm starting to think about that. So kind of a long answer, Commissioner, but I think the main defense is saying, hey, we have to get really aware of the fact that as human beings, our brains are efficient. And they want to stop thinking about things in that efficiency, and we have to force ourselves back into that system too, that slow thinking.
Yeah, because we have a tendency, I think, to ultimately just go to a checklist, you know, and how do you keep it vital, you know, so thank you.
Sure.
Good presentation, and I certainly appreciated the fact that you went through each of the steps and talk about how 40 years prior is where the first brick was laid for the problems that ultimately decimated the sound. So thank you. Makes a lot of sense. It's very common sense when you lay it out like that, and it's easy for somebody like me to understand it. So thank you very much. You bet. So, commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Are there any wishes to modify that consent agenda? Hearing none, then we will ask if anyone wants to approve the consent agenda as stated.
Move to approve the consent agenda as stated.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any comments, discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The ayes have it. All right, Steve.
Okay, I want to start with our monthly cycle of personal ownership winner. And so really, really pleased with this one because we've talked a lot about cybersecurity and how important cybersecurity is. And this is a great example for us. That's Lauren Connor. And Lauren, I hope you could come on up and join us at the table. Lauren took personal ownership with respect to email technology. I'm not sure we've talked about this very much. We did, as a result of our work with a large public power council, there have been some suggestions that we work with BitSight technology that helps us to identify where we might have weaknesses in our system. They had identified a couple, particularly with respect to email. And then we had to do something. Somebody had to take accountability here. And Lauren was the guy who stepped forward and did. And we feel like he's been able to put fixes in place, minimal disruption to email services, which, of course, we all are so dependent on now. We'd all noticed if there had been problems. And we seem to, at least according to the BitSight review, seem to be doing much better in that regard. So I wanted to say thank you to Lauren and give him a chance, if you wanted to just talk a little bit about the work that he's been doing.
I didn't really have a speech prepared, but hi, everybody. I told everybody when we had the meeting earlier last week that essentially there's a number of steps that could be taken to try and improve email security. Email wasn't designed to be secure to start with. It wasn't really thought of at the time that it was designed that somebody could abuse it. And so it is designed in such a way that you just automatically accept it without checking the identity of who it was that sent it in the first place. That also makes it very easily forged. So what we took steps to do is publish some records that allow people to check when they receive mail from us. Who actually sent this? Are they allowed to send on behalf of the organization that sent the message in the first place? And has the content been altered in delivery? And so people that now receive messages from us should have a much clearer idea that it really did come from us and they can trust it if they wish to do so. So we'll continue to monitor things as technology advances and make changes and updates as necessary. But now our mail should be more trustworthy to the rest of the world.
For a guy who didn't have a speech prepared, it's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, appreciate it.
Yeah, nice job, Lauren. One of the things that certainly keeps me awake at night is the possibility of some kind of a cyber event. So knowing that you're there watching through the email section of the potential, that makes me sleep a little bit better. So thanks, Lauren. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, commissioners, we will toss it back to you. This is the quarterly board balance scorecard report.
Okay. And do you want to take the first one?
I guess I'll just explain why. We're doing this on an exceptional basis. So I guess this is a bit of an exception. It shows red under sustain our public partnership. We have two key indicators. One is board attendance at Tri-Commission regional stakeholder meetings, and the second one is attendance at quarterly Mid-C commissioner manager meetings. Our targets, the target on the first one is 75%. On Mid-C meetings at 60%, and we're falling slightly below those at 60% and 40%. In both cases, that's because of a scheduling conflict. So I'm guessing that this will all come out in the wash at the end. I think we'll be where we need to be by the end of the year.
And if I can jump in, and I'll say that this evening there is a Mid-C meeting, quarterly commissioner manager meeting, and I know that'll give us an opportunity to up that score.
Yeah, that location is?
Miley Thai in East Wenatchee.
Which is?
On East One.
It's on Grant.
It's on Grant Road.
On Grant? Okay.
It's basically the corner of Grant and Eastmont, that plaza that's there.
Used to be Lulu's?
Oh, yes, it used to be Lulu's, correct. All right. Okay. That is right, yes.
Thank you. This is Wenatchee. You have to talk about what it used to
what
be.
What
it
used
to be. Not so much what it is.
I'll take the next one, which is to maintain strong financial stewardship. The key indicator is quarterly operating and financial review presented by management, board checks for adherence to budget, long-range plans, guidance, principles, policies, and acceptable risk levels. And the annual target is four meetings, one each quarter. Year-to-date, we have met two of those, and we're halfway through the year, so that category is green.
Okay, ensuring effective execution. The areas are green, and we're on track, and I don't see any reason why we can't continue that.
And under improving the strategy and business planning, we've got a green and two whites, and the two whites are in progress and I believe are on track to be completed by the end of the year when we adopt the budget.
I do have a question on the execution. Yeah, annual evaluation of general counsel. Do we have a target date on that? Eric, do you know?
Say again.
So we have a target date on your annual evaluation, or
yeah, it's the end
of the year. Or do we just get to make one up?
So I serve at your pleasure. You tell me when to show up, and I show up. as a general rule, we take care of that in either December or January as necessary. Right. So we target the end of the year.
Okay.
Steve has two. I have one.
All right. And that's not an editorial comment.
It is what it is.
Thank you.
Take G3, responsible board representation. This is regional, national association meetings. I thought as the new board member that they give you this because this is the one that we can never quite get to in compliance. And I report to you report after report that we're still working on it. But I'm really pleased to tell you we've met our targets and everything is green.
And I think under insurance compliance, we're all green, so I don't need to go over those.
And then evaluate governance positions. Everything is green there. We've done our annual review of our own policies. Code of Ethics, looking at everything that governs this body, and we're in compliance there.
Okay, related to continuous improvement of the board, for the most part, the position that we've taken is you're currently kind of responsible for your own, you know, and finding where that goes and where you need to make your improvements and that kind of thing. And looking at our budget, I'm concerned that we're essentially at the end of our budget for that category. Presently, and I think we need to make a budget transfer internally because it seems of high value. If you look at where the commission is walking, you know, we've been pursuing some things individually, and which is what we've agreed to do, and then it leads to a collective understanding. But I would like us to clean up our budget and make sure that we're tracking that within perhaps the budget or an approved altered budget.
Okay.
Because we're about out of money in that category.
I would suggest that would be a good one to have the clerk of the board work with the president of the board to make a proposal on.
Okay.
Rebecca, and I like that arrangement.
Rebecca, maybe you've got some time. Just let me know and we'll get together on that.
Thank you.
And
I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that we slow down because the whole power business is fluid. Mm-hmm. And I think there's perhaps a higher requirement to keep on board training than there has been.
Well, and thank you for bringing that up, the budget item. We certainly are facing as commissioners much more of a fluid energy market, and not just energy, but all the other services that we provide as a utility company that require constant vigilance. So,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, and looking at the budget, if we continue our pace in other areas as well, we do have internal funds that we can transfer line item to balance it out.
And I think I've mentioned to this commission already that in November I will be attending again as training a cybersecurity conference that will, of course, add to the budget.
Yeah.
And thank you.
It's critical that we continue to do that.
Thank you.
Just a comment. I don't think we'll go over all of the individual sheets of what we've attended over the first couple of quarters, but I just want to say thank you to Rebecca for tracking on this third one, the informational only, not to be reported on the... That has great value for me. As a matter of fact, I'll talk with you because I missed a couple. I was on a couple of these that I failed to report to you. So, but that really shows a picture of what we commissioners are doing. And there's a lot of activity going on.
There is quite a bit.
Yeah.
Has everyone had an opportunity to look over the scorecard matrix, and are they in agreement with the meetings that have been attended?
I'll make my corrections. I've got a couple on here that I was there and just didn't report it.
Okay, thank you. I thought I had marked one that I had seen exactly that you were there that wasn't on here, so I'm glad you caught it.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks, Randy. Okay. Well, I think that winds up the scorecard matrix.
Good. Commissioner. Okay, next up, we've got an issue regarding delegation of real estate authority to staff. Eric's going to lead this one.
Thank you, commissioners. I'm trying to figure out where's the best place to drive from. Yeah, great. Is it up and down? You're so good. Thank you. I'm technologically challenged, commissioners, if you didn't know that already. So Eric Walquist, General Counsel. Commissioners, the next item is mine, and this is a housekeeping item, really, that I want to propose. It's a discussion topic today. There is no board action required today. But as part of the work over the last several years, we've seen an increasing number of transactions that have led us to think that it's a good opportunity to take out, dust off, and look at the delegation resolutions associated with real estate transactions from the board. We first had some back in 2003, most recently 2008 was the last time they looked at, so more than a decade, it's time to look at them again. You recall recently we did the procurement resolutions for the same type of a review, also from the same vintage era, and this is just next on the list. So historically, the board has delegated routine and other administrative real estate transactions to staff. We currently have two that we operate under. One is for what I will call general administrative or routine real estate transactions, and the other is for dock permits and buoys. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen a number of increasing matters that, frankly, I consider to be routine and we've historically considered to be routine have to come to the board. And this is simply because over the years, as you know, we've, at your suggestion, become better stewards of the real estate properties that we have. We've completed the real estate property and parcel inventory. You know, the shoreline management program has been developed and implemented. It's not a requirement for us, but it's still done for ease and information to the public. And as the technology and tools become more easily available, we do continue to find opportunities to fine-tune some of our parcels and how we manage things. That does increase the number of increase the number of transactions that we see ourselves faced with in the real estate side of things. So this is where my father, who was a English lit professor, would take me to task, because I indicate on this third page that we have two objectives, and then I realize in the first one I use the conjunctive and, which suggests that there's actually three, which is, to be honest with you, sort of how I think about the objectives of the housekeeping exercise here. The first is as suggested in item one, I do want to combine the two resolutions into one simply for convenience and ease of reference for staff. There's no meaningful reason that we have those resolutions separated in any fashion, and the fewer we have, I'll steal from Jeremy and say the more likely it is that we can avoid error in interpreting and applying those resolutions. The conjunctive part of that is I do think there's an opportunity to better define what the routine real estate transactions are, and I'll get back to that here in a little bit, that we've delegated from the board to staff. And then the second item on this list is the, like we did in the earlier procurement resolution, administratively, it makes much more sense, I think, to delegate those instead of, in this instance, past the general manager, but to the general manager, so that the general manager then can redelegate as he believes appropriate downward into the utility. But we do know then that there's a clear line of accountability, chain of command, and a reporting relationship between the general manager and the board that we can keep you fully informed. So I'm going to take these in the two that I've listed earlier, which is that I do want to take this opportunity to combine and simplify and clarify the existing resolutions here. I want to preface these comments and say that the intent is not to change or add anything into the delegations that it was not already intended be included in that. And I'll circle back to this at the bottom, but I do want to be very clear that those things that you would expect to come to the board that have historically come to the board, they will continue to come to the board. Whenever we're talking about surplusage of real property and the sale of real property for a price to a person on what terms and conditions, that will still come to the board. And the purchase of real estate parcels by fee or purchase and sale agreement, those will still come to the board. So this is truly those housekeeping type routine use related transactions, which I want to say that even though delegated, the board still is made aware of frequently through manager's items and other opportunities. So it doesn't mean just because it's delegated that there's not an opportunity for information. But we have a fundamental flaw, I think, in the existing delegation resolutions that has created a lot of time for staff, mine, the auditors, real estate, talking about what the intent of those resolutions were. There are fundamentally two schools of drafting thought. The first one is try to create your list, and the other is be more general. When you try to, I fall into the latter just in case there's any question. When you try to generate a specific list, you know almost automatically that you've forgotten something from the list that you will discover in short order. And actually, we have that in our current resolution. We created a specific list. We thought it was inclusive. It is not inclusive. And we have had a number of those examples that I'll get to in a minute. Primarily boundary line adjustment and no fee property exchange that have been called out, come to the board recently that were never intended to come to the board. But those, the way that it was drafted has created a substantial amount of resource time trying to interpret and prepare for how best to bring those transactions to conclusion, whether we do or don't come to the board, and what those agreements look like. So the proposal, and I'm ahead of myself, is to combine the two resolutions into one resolution and to try to better define through the generalist drafting routine transactions and what those mean. And currently we do it by document or transaction type. I've chosen to do it a little bit differently by defining routine real estate transactions. And so I've given in the delegation resolution, I've kept a lot of those provisions that define the specific types of transactions, but I've also added effectively one catch-all provision that says other general administrative transactions of this sort. And I've defined those, as I've done earlier, by exclusion, which is it does not include those things like surplus and disposition of real property or the purchase of parcel by fee. So those are still reserved to the board. So the second piece, is very similar to what you saw in the procurement. I won't spend a ton of time on it, but the bottom line is I think there is huge value in delegating instead of past the general manager, but to the general manager. And so I've given you here for your thinking and for the public the proposal and some of the value proposition. So I've mentioned already before what it won't change, the surplus and sale of all parcels of real property. There are some statutory and internal processes that we require prior to that occurring and coming to the board. Those will still come to the board. We will still set a hearing, and we will still have board action. And then similarly, we will have board approval for purchase of real estate parcels. So I want to be very clear that our historic treatment has been, and you are familiar with it at this point in time, that we would go out when we identify a valuable piece of property or properties, and we would try to negotiate with the property owner or the seller a set of terms and conditions, including price and other commercial terms that would be acceptable to the seller and, at least as a placeholder, acceptable to staff as a recommendation to the board. That's the purchase and sale agreement. That purchase and sale agreement is typically brought forward to the board as a contingent purchase and sale because we do not close any of those purchase transactions without the board having its briefing, understanding the terms that have been proposed, having the opportunity to ask those questions, and then make a decision about whether those terms, while acceptable to a seller and to staff, are indeed acceptable to the board. So those do not change. Just to wrap here and be certain I'm clear, I want to do, and this is back where I broke it down into the three, so in spite of my two earlier, here's three. I do want to combine one resolution. That would change. We would not have two. We would have single resolution, single point of authority. Second, delegate to, not pass, the general manager. And third, make clear that routine administrative transactions are delegated. What that means, effectively, if you look at the delegation resolution, which I will forward you, the draft of the new and the existing two delegations, because the next steps will be for us to visit and talk about whether these things are acceptable and what challenges you see. It does require adding two sections. The first of them, well, I would submit they're both housekeeping. The first one is agency documents. So we have always treated agency documents as within the delegation of authority scope because of the documents that, in my world, provide the legislative history for how that resolution was generated. So these are the conditional use permit applications that our properties department routinely files when you approve the purchase of a parcel for a substation site. We are required to go through the county's conditional use permitting process to mitigate against unsightliness or noise or whatever other complaints that the surrounding property owners might bring forward. So those things we have always treated as within the scope of delegated authority. But now that we are opening this and looking potentially at some housekeeping, it makes sense to make absolutely clear that those things are within that scope. They are not expressly within the current scope. They are within the implied scope because of the background documents. So that's the first change. It is really one of convenience. It is not a change to our practice. The second one is the other real estate transaction provision, which I've talked about earlier. This is a bit of a change in the sense that it does provide clarity that things that are outside of that specifically delineated list that exist in the current delegation resolution, but are similar in spirit and scope and purpose, are included within that delegated authority. So recently you have seen on three occasions, I think, here, boundary line adjustments. Boundary line, no fee, like property exchanges. There was one with the Skyline water reservoir where we needed some property from an adjacent owner, and we did just a swap for no cost of same valued property so that we could complete our project. There was one where we had a property owner, I think in South Wenatchee, who had built a fence over on some of our property, and it became more convenient, certainly was within and did not impact our use of our property. Rather than to force them to remove, relocate at expense the fence line, we were able to secure an equivalent acreage of their property and just do a boundary line adjustment. Did not impact us or them. They could continue to enjoy the use of what they had always believed was their property, but we were able to secure the same value or consideration for the district without impact any of the district use of that property. We also have and occasionally do what I call title clearing quick claim deeds. So because of the number of parcels the district has and because of the history of those parcels, we do have occasion where someone will come to us and there will be some cloud is what we call it in the law on title of a particular parcel of real estate. And there's some title company who has identified some document in the usually long historic past that suggests that the district has an ownership interest in that parcel or a rights interest, whether it's easement or otherwise. And sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. And where we don't, we issue quick claim deeds to clear title so that another transaction can proceed to closing. There's always a full investigation of that, but those currently are not within the scope of the existing delegation resolution. So the best example that I have of that, and we continue to do it routinely, periodically as the matter issues. And I don't believe any of you were sitting commissioners at the time that this issue came up, but early on in my career with the district, we had an issue that came up over a cloud of title on some of the property adjacent to the Columbia River between Rocky Reach and Rock Island because of the way those lots in East Wenatchee were platted originally long before I was born. East Wenatchee Land Company platted them with lot lines and specific lot numbers. And when, I don't know if any of you remember Dr. Stephen Talbot, he was a dentist, but when he purchased some of the land from the State Department of Transportation and was going to do a development, one of the title companies came forward and said, hey, there's a cloud on title because there's a legal issue about whether when I conveyed lots, I conveyed to the lot lines or I conveyed to the high water mark of the river. So there was arguably these unplatted strips of land between the lot lines and the high watermark. We actually seeking the opportunity to clarify it between two public entities, started a quote-unquote friendly lawsuit, which quickly became unfriendly, between the district and the State Department of Transportation to ask the court to make a decision on that issue, who actually owned it and what was the legal effect of the way it was platted. That decision was issued by Judge Bridges 20-plus years ago, and it was resolved against the district, and frankly, which was fine with the district at the time. And as a result of that, we have been, when those issues come forward and people can't do whatever they need to do on their property, we've been issuing those quitclaim deeds to clear title. So it's that kind of a process that periodically comes up from time to time that's really an administrative matter. It doesn't impact the district's use or rights. Those are long established. So that's the proposal that I'm making to you, is that we would take this opportunity to do some housekeeping and clean those things up. And those are the types of transactions that have been excluded and we would like to seek to include. So not, in my view, seeking to get any additional authority that wasn't intended to be delivered in terms of the administrative nature of these transactions, but does include some transactions that I think were omitted from the original resolution that need to be included. So this is a concept, like the last time with the procurement resolution, that I'm proposing to you because I think it's consistent with what has historically been intended. But it is also the opening of a conversation, an opportunity to chat with each of you about whether that meets your expectations or not. So my heads up to you will be I'll be circling out with each of you to try to make sure that I've addressed any concerns you have. And then assuming we will address those, I would envision coming back under the next steps to the board and seeking to give you the feedback that I have elicited individually from you collectively, and then we could have a conversation about the acceptable path forward. So a heads up more than anything that this is coming, and start of a conversation. Questions about any of that, concerns that I should be aware of as we start moving forward here?
Eric, on slide 9, under 2, other routine transactions, is there a different word other than routine? And the reason why I'm bringing that up is, you know, we just went through a session on drift. And routine has a tendency to marry itself to drift.
Sure. So I would suggest to you that I think we can put whatever word that you would like in there, and I'm open to those. This was a placeholder. The more important aspect of that will be how we define what is included. So the same challenge you have when you try to lay out a list, you see with those definitions. So what I have done, and it's not an uncommon approach to things in the law, is I have defined it by exclusion. So rather than trying to identify everything possibly that would be included, I have defined what those are by what they do not include. So the things that come still to the board. And then I will tell you that there is no perfect solution. So there will be issues no matter what we put in there that we will still need to explore together, and that may, for one reason or another, still come to the board because it doesn't feel like it was within the spirit of what was intended in the delegation resolution. I view that as my obligation to the board, working in conjunction with the delegee, who will be the general manager in this instance, to just have that candid conversation of this is the kind of thing that the board should be aware of. And that is tasked to both the general manager and general counsel in the governance policies that speak to the relationship between the board and those positions.
Okay.
But yes, happy, open, no pride in authorship.
So Eric, as we get ready to prepare for this resolution, you're going to bring some more documentation to us to review. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, so I will send you probably in the next week or so the existing resolutions, and then I will send you the draft resolution as well. It might have been attached to your package already, but I'll call it out specifically in an email that comes from me.
Good. Commissioners, any other questions?
Great. Thanks. Thank you, Eric.
One just thought. So related to the North Shore substation.
Commissioner.
This process as described probably would have cut that off at the pass and made it more obvious.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's a function of the delegation past the general manager. So there's a very special relationship between the board and the general manager set out in your governance policies, among other things, that doesn't exist between this board or this body and the people that necessarily are below the general manager. So one of the reasons that I'm seeking to delegate administratively directly to the general manager.
Yeah, because there are great surprises in life, and then there are others.
Not so great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioners.
Okay, with that, we're ready to move to item 6 will be a surplus property proposal. So Lisa Graves will be making that presentation for us. Joined by Vicki Griffin.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning. I'm Lisa Graves, real estate specialist. I'm here with Vicki Griffin, our real estate department manager. We're here to request the board to set a hearing to consider declaring a piece of property surplus that is in Douglas County, just south of the BB Bridge. Douglas County Fire Protection District, this is first slide here is just to give you an idea of the general location. Douglas County Fire Protection District number 4 has identified an area within their district that they have a need for a new fire station. UD District owns this parcel right here, which is nearly perfectly situated to satisfy that need for a fire station. So the fire district approached the district about acquiring the property for a fire station. We've been working through some due diligence on this project. The district staff did an internal review and determined that the district does not have a need for this property at this time. It is not within our project boundary. It is not a part of the park and will not be used for a part of the park. The great majority of the property itself is not usable. It's very, very steep. Where the fire station would go up near the northerly end is really the only part of the property that's flat enough to be developed. Another limiting factor for this piece of property is that WSDOT controls the access. It's very limited. We actually had to go to WSDOT to see if they would allow a fire station to have access to the highway from that spot. So, and WSDOT's agreed to do that. There is a distribution line that the district used to own, which was a part of the transfer to Douglas PUD a few years back. So Douglas PUD has an easement for that distribution line. It runs along the westerly boundary of the parcel. The district requested that the fire district have the property appraised. They hired a third-party appraiser that was approved by the district to appraise the property. From that, we've negotiated other details of a purchase and sale agreement based upon that appraised value of $95,000. And so we're here today to ask you to set a hearing to consider whether this property would be surplus to district needs. And then should that be so, then we would also ask you to consider a resolution to approve the sale to Douglas County Fire District 4.
That request for the resolution to surplus would be, of course, after you decided to surplus the property at the next meeting, we would have that available if that was your. One other note on the access to the property. The only access WSDOT allows out there is for agriculture or utilities, but they did agree to allow the access for the fire station.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you to the staff for the very thorough explanation that was provided to me when I raised questions over the weekend about this large of a parcel of property transferring from one public entity to another. And I'm a guy that loves to see as much property as possible in private ownership. But the response that I got was absolutely tremendous, and the understanding that I gained about this parcel of property. So I understand clearly at this point that this is probably the best use we could ever hope for, and recognizing there's so much development that has gone on in Douglas County in that area, and the need for a fire station in that area is very real. So thank you for all of the updates you provided me.
The county residents north of the bridge up here will, Chief Odie from Douglas County Forest let us know that they've got a lot of interest, and it will help with those residents because they have, their insurance rates will come down. And additionally, we just recently, the district had a call to BB Park. And Chief Odie said to me, you know, if we'd have had a station close, our response time would have been a lot quicker.
The other thing that we're accepting from this is any water rights that go with the property. So we'll retain those water rights as but they can be used on our property as well.
Oh, interesting. We can do that?
Yes. You can retain the water rights in a sale. If you don't retain them, it's assumed that they go with the sale. If you retain them, then you can keep those water rights as you move forward.
And so the fire district does not need those water rights?
They said no. Going to drill a well for their needs.
So
basically they just want internal for their domestic needs and to do a little bit of irrigation, and they determined that they just wanted to drill a well to access that.
So the existing water right the district has, water rights will cover a specific area, but they are prove to the area they're historically used on, so they're not there. But what we're going to do is an administrative division just to make sure that the description of where the water right that the district currently owns applies specifically to the park, which is where we've been using it. And the fire district, they can drill an exempt well, so they don't need a water right for that. And they have stated that that exempt well will provide them the water that they need for their purposes. Clarify? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
And they know that there's water there. So if they drilled a hole, they have water.
They have an opportunity, should we approve the purchase and sale agreement, to do any due diligence that they would like to do.
Okay. Okay. I also want to thank staff for explaining some of the issues that surround ever using this parcel for expansion of BB Park. As I was pondering this over the weekend, that was a thought that came to mind that maybe long after I'm departed from this earth, there might be a need to expand. And since that is not within our project boundary, we don't have authority to do that. And also the topography is such that it's so hilly, there really isn't an opportunity to put campsites on that side of the Highway 97. So thank you very much for explaining that to me and bringing clarity. Thank you.
I just want to think on it some more, but so the fire district does buy that piece of property and we retain the water rights. Well, so they get in, they own the property, they go to drill a well and they can't get adequate water. So then they're going to almost certainly come back to us and say, you know, we really need water. We need to serve the public, and then we're going to feel great pressure to give up our water right. I mean, hypothetical, but I'm concerned about that. I don't want to give up any water rights.
Right, and our retaining the water right would not give them the water that they need for a fire station, or take away from their ability to get water for the fire station. They don't need the water right, and that property has not historically had water being used on it. So Department of Ecology considers a water right proved by its historic place of use. So we just happen to have a case where, as we'd find a lot of our older water rights, they described a much larger area than the water right was actually used on, and we're just kind of cleaning that up with this, and they've agreed to completing the administrative division form that we have from the Department of Ecology to just state that the water will be used where it's currently and historically been used, which is the part of the property west of the highway at the park.
Commissioner, maybe the best way to handle this is, so your thoughts on desire to give water rights is now clear on the record. We're only asking you to set a hearing today to determine surplus, but we can certainly
visit with them later.
We can certainly take your message and the message back to the fire district and say, get in there and do the due diligence that Lisa suggests they have the ability to do prior to coming back to the board for that decision, which under the now existing and future proposed, note the plug, delegation resolution would still come to the board. So we can certainly carry that message back and make sure they have the opportunity to validate all that before we close a transaction.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll visit with you one-on-one some more, too.
In addition to that, there are other wells on that side of the river. There isn't a lot of development because it's so steep there. Mm-hmm. There are 20-acre tracts that go clear up and over the hill in which people have developed water to serve their residences there. So there's water there, whether it's easy to get to or not, might be.
Yeah, it's just more and more demands on water and more wells going in. And it's
and potentially it would be a different type of water right anyway. If ours is an irrigation water right, and they need something other than irrigation. So, I ready for a motion?
Yes, I'm. Commissioners, anyone care to make a motion?
I would move to set a public hearing for August 5, 2019 at 1 p.m. to consider the declaration of an approximately 45-acre parcel of land on US 2/97 south of the BB Bridge in Douglas County surplus to the district's needs and direct staff to give the required notice of the hearing.
Do we hear a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion?
Is this considered an upstream water right?
Upstream of what?
Exactly.
Yeah, so it is the water that it is, and upstream, downstream primarily relates to if you ever want to move that water, you can't move it up, you have to move it down.
Okay, that was my question. So if we did,
it's potentially that if we were
those water rights, we could move it downstream but not up.
So there are a number of opportunities that we're currently exploring as to how we can preserve, maintain, and potentially reassign water rights throughout the district's portfolio of rights. This is certainly among those.
Okay, that answers my question.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The ayes have it. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. A lot of work and effort on that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next up, we'd like to give you an update on the development of our regional transmission planning organization. There are two existing regional transmission planning organization now. There's been a lot of conversation over the last couple of years about merging those. Kirk Hudson will be describing the status of that effort.
Good morning, Managing Director, Generation and Transmission, Kirk Hudson. Just a brief update on regional transmission planning. We've been involved the last couple of years with Columbia Grid and discussions with Northern Tier Transmission Group and combining the two organizations into a larger footprint planning organization. That's been very successful to date, and we have plans underway to make that combination of organizations effective January 1st, 2020. What you see here is a map on the screen that shows what the footprint of Northern Grid would be. Columbia Grid right now is predominantly Washington, Northern Idaho, part of Western Montana, and then into a big chunk of Western Oregon. So you can see the footprint gets extended quite a bit. I won't read all the organizations. You can see from the presentation, the organizations are involved with Columbia Grid and the ones that are involved with Northern Tier Transmission Group. You can also see the creative thinking of the name Northern Grid. If you take the first word out of Northern Tier Transmission Group and the second half of Columbia Grid, that's how we arrived at Northern Grid as the new organization.
So what's the differentiation between, other than color, between the light purple and the dark purple?
I was thinking
maybe it was density of population, but Eastern Oregon's in there.
Yeah, there's really no distinction. I'm not sure what
what that
dark purple versus the light purple is. You can actually, you can kind of, if you look at the transmission lines themselves, it really doesn't lend itself to a different scale of purple color. So it's a good question.
So what's the difference?
Okay,
thank you.
Could very well be, no, it's not that either. I was thinking it might be service territories, but it looks like that is the case as well. So the value of the larger footprint, obviously, one common set of data and assumptions, is also a possibility and the likelihood of eliminating duplicative administrative functions of two organizations under one organization, as well as the public outreach efforts. You have a single stakeholder forum rather than multiple forums if there's planning projects across the two different organizations. Main objectives we're trying to meet here is to meet the regulatory requirements for those that are under FERC jurisdiction, the investor-owned utilities. So any requirements we have in the planning process will meet those requirements that will actually have to be approved by FERC. And so just last week we had a pre-filing meeting with FERC, and there's comments that we are addressing and questions we're answering as part of this process, but we do plan to file the documentation with FERC later on this month, likely around the July 25th timeframe for their review. The next steps is a couple of agreements that I'll be reviewing, and it's a planning agreement plus a funding agreement. Membership cost is approximately $65,000 per year in the new regional planning organization. I mentioned the FERC filing later this month. I'll plan to begin operations January 1, and Columbia Grid wind down with the current functional agreements will actually occur through 2020, which will make sure we have clear transition and not a stop and a start right off the bat on the first day. With that, are there any questions?
One right out of the chute. Just back on your participants, one group I've never heard of, Desiree. It's the on the map.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be the best to be able to tell you where their service territory is.
So Desiree is over in Utah, and they are connected into the Pacific Power System, Pacific Core System now, and that's why they fit in the Northwest component. So Pacific Core stretches pretty far into Utah and Wyoming, and so they just happen to sit in the middle of that that service territory.
And here I was thinking Desiree was Neil Diamond.
We'll have to check to see if they're part of that too, whether Neil is.
Kirk, I must be confused. I thought Portland General Electric, Pacific Core, probably Puget Sound Energy. I thought they were all either considering joining Cal ISO or had already joined.
So
what am I missing?
Something. No, I think the piece is the distinction between transmission planning and then energy imbalance market.
Well, this is just the transmission
two
planning
separate
piece
things.
Of it.
And not to confuse things even more, there's also the reliability coordinator function that groups are choosing to be part of or not to, including the Cal ISO. So this is completely separate from the things I think you're mainly reading about in the energy imbalance market or reliability coordination.
Commissioners, any other questions?
In Cal ISO, the white areas?
So those are public power service territories, balancing area of Northern California, Turlock, that did not want to be part of the CAISO when it first started up. They've been inching towards becoming more involved in the CAISO, but this is a place where it's very similar to EIM and the Reliability Coordination Services. They've chosen to participate and those activities with CAISO, but not transmission planning so far.
So that big white area probably includes SMUD?
Yes.
It's interesting. Turlock is the original model for PUDs. It historically came in first with the combination, and essentially the PUDs in the state of Washington were patterned after Turlock.
I didn't know that.
There we go. See, when you teach that class, you just all kinds of stuff sneaks
Homer
in.
Homer T. Bone here. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, but no, right. Just, you know, they're a group of farmers who decided to harness irrigation. And, oh, by the way, we can do electricity, too. And it became the combination that led this state to start looking at the formation of PUDs.
Interesting.
Good. So there we go.
Kirk, thank
they'll
you.
Be, they'll
appreciate
be
it.
A test afterwards.
So, Commissioners, we anticipated there was a good chance that we would move through the morning agenda swiftly, and we are prepared to move into the afternoon agenda if you would like, starting with the consent agenda.
Okay. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Is there a motion to accept that consent?
Did we already do that?
You already approved that.
We did that this morning already.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
I'm just kind of
so we have a regular answer.
Okay. So what I'd like to do is we do have one resolution on a regular agenda. It's a resolution approving the purchase and sale agreement with the Nidio and Elizabeth Tontini Living Trust for the purchase of real property and authorizing the general manager or his designee to complete the transaction. Dan Frazier will present. This would be my suggestion, though, because this issue did hit the paper last week, that we provide the presentation to you. But I would suggest that you not act until we hit the 1 o'clock time frame. So that if by chance there was somebody that wanted to come, that we haven't acted in advance of what the scheduled agenda shows.
All right.
So we would just move through and have the conversation now and then be ready to act when we come back at 1 o'clock.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Commissioners, Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. I'm here to present to you the resolution for the purchase of the property that we talked about last week, the presentation. This is a 2.12-acre parcel. A former home of the Haran House property is adjacent to the southern boundary of the property that the PUD recently acquired from the Port of Chelan County for the new service center. Nothing has really changed since the presentation 2 weeks ago. Terms of the deal are the same. No new things came out of our continued due diligence on the property. This we've done these things as a favor to our general counsel to bring two real estate transactions to you along with his delegation presentation. So we can show you this is really
I already sent him a bill.
Yeah. So this is definitely not routine to show you. This is something that as Eric described is a really good way for us to acquire property because we can work on the terms and conditions of those outside of the public eye, and then when those are established to some level of comfort, then we can bring them into a board meeting, have that discussion. Where there's not a pressure to adjust price, and so we can have those conversations in the public. So, again, this is a contingent purchase and sale agreement, and the contingency that's left is the board's approval. So I offer to answer any questions you have.
The only kind of zinger that I got on this is that was someone who asked the question, you know, why is the PUD paying double for the property what Tontini's did? And I said, if you take 2008, to 2019, that 11-year period of time, and you go up 5% a year and then compound it, what do you get? Just about double.
Yeah. We did have it appraised.
Yeah.
And this is slightly higher than the appraisal, although lower than the neighboring parcels we purchased.
Yeah.
It was well within the reasonable amount to pay for this property. And as people recall, in 2008, the market was severely depressed.
Yeah.
I think people got a lot of bargains for property in 2008 and 9 and 10. And now we see where the market is today, and we are working in today's market.
Yep. But that was really the only question I had that was pointed. Okay.
Commissioners, any comments, questions, inquiries?
Okay.
No?
Right. Thanks. So we'll bring this back when we reconvene at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thanks. I'd like to move to manager items. Invite Kirk Hudson up to talk about outreach on a project we previously discussed, the proposal for replacement transmission up in the Plain and Lake Wenatchee area.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation Transmission. Just wanted to provide you the schedule. We've been in front of you a couple of times talking about the Plain Lake Wenatchee outreach with the different transmission line options for fire and weather hardening. We do have a couple of meetings scheduled with outreach to the public, the first one being this Wednesday from 3:30 to 5:30 at the Beaver Valley Lodge. And then we've got another one scheduled for those that might be not resident weekly on a regular basis, but Saturday, July 27th, 10 a.m. to noon up in the Leavenworth PUD office, and plan to lay out the different options for the community and get feedback and input on those different options for fire hardening and weather hardening, and just gauge the pulse, if you will, on receptiveness to the community up there for looking further at those options. So just wanted to make sure you knew those were scheduled and provide the opportunity if any of you wanted to attend.
Commissioners, it might be helpful for staff to know if we were to have a quorum wishing to attend at any of these meetings. Anyone know for sure that they would be able to attend or would desire to attend these meetings? No? No? Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, I want to invite Ron Slabaugh and Ingrid Miller to talk about news on Department of Ecology funding for our Pashaston wastewater project.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning,
Ron Slabaugh, Water Wastewater Manager, Ingrid Miller. We were here, believe it or not, in January. It's been that long. We had some good news. We had applied for additional funding for Pashaston in October of 2018, and we got some initial news from the state that we were on the draft offer list. Out of 139 applications submitted, we ranked second. We just had to wait for the legislature to approve the dollars in the capital budget, which they did. And in late June, we received another letter informing us that we had made the final offer list. And that is for another $745,000 in low-interest loan, $412 in grant to complete construction of our Pashaston Wastewater Improvements Project. Next step is just to work with the state on amending our existing funding application to include those dollars.
That's great. Very good.
So just call it to your attention that, of course, we have the issue of trying to set wastewater rates for the next 5 years coming through strategic planning. Costs of this project are higher than was originally anticipated. This certainly helps with addressing that problem, but we will still have to deal with the remaining additional costs as we think through rate issues. So we'll be talking more about that over the course of the next month or two.
And construction is well underway?
It is.
Yeah. Yep. I know the contractor's nervous about harvest time when the big flows come from the warehouses.
Yeah, they are, and we're talking with them today, in fact, about the plan for taking some of the facilities down and getting them back in service as soon as possible. Our understanding from the fruit warehouses up there is they anticipate going into operation about mid-August. That sound right?
Yep.
Good.
Yep.
Good. Sure. So we're currently still on track with the progress that has been made thus far on being completed with the major construction by the end of the year. And we received a new permit from Ecology effective June 1st of this year that establishes that we have to be compliant with the new discharge requirements by March 1st, 2020.
Yeah, the contractor sits in front of me in church, so he always bends my ear every Sunday, so just so you know.
Oh. Interesting. Orchard.
Okay.
I want to say thank you to Ingrid for her work in helping to prepare the grant application and pulling it together. Ingrid, anything you would like to add?
I just did what Ron told me. He does a really good job as far as understanding the wastewater needs and how to put this together. So he did a lot of the wording. I was just more on the numbers side. So. But he is well regarded with Ecology. So that second ranking really was due to his work.
Well, thank you. And I have to mention, too, although we're here just to talk about the funding for the project, once we get the funding, and we move into construction, there's a lot more work behind the scenes that Ingrid completes on the compliance side for our debt and our grants and keeping the contractor and all their subs and all of the requirements in place that keeps us eligible for this funding is a challenge. You know, the book that comes along with this funding, the instruction book, it's about this thick. Yeah.
It's a combination of ecology and EPA funding, so both federal and state infused guidelines, and so it's quite a bit of work, and it's a lot of work for the procurement area too when it comes to pulling this together.
And so far, so good.
I have a great appreciation for what you're doing. I once applied for a low-interest loan on disaster with USDA, and I said never again. Because
yeah, commissioners, I want to echo that and say in all of the work that we do with the grant funding, Ingrid is absolutely indispensable to that effort. She really does keep us in compliance with all of those rules and responsibilities that come with the money and the low-interest loans. It's not a free ride by any stretch, and I know she spends a lot of time with audit staff and my staff and the project staff making sure that we can meet all of those, reviewing all the documents, and then following up to make sure we stay in compliance. So I want to say thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
You. Next up, we've got a couple of Lake Chelan project items. We'll start with Suzanne Grissel, and looks like she's got maybe some folks joining her today. Talk about the we do have a low impact hydro institute certification, and that was running out. Needed to pull that back together again. Suzanne led that team with some able support from the Fish and Wildlife Group.
Sure. I'm Suzanne Grissel, Governmental Affairs Program Manager in our External Affairs Group. Thank you very much for having us here today. We are excited to report that we have been recertified as a low impact hydro project for the Lake Chelan project. This certification came from an independent organization called the Low Impact Hydropower Institute. It has a board of environmental groups, hydro professionals, and national labs, and they basically look at your project from criteria including environmental, recreation, cultural, and natural resources. So we first received this certification in 2007 and have had it renewed once. But they changed their criteria in 2014, and it became a much more rigorous process. And we were evaluated based on different zones of the project and how our project met criteria in a variety of zones of the project. And we're very pleased that after a public comment period and a number of conversations with members of the Low Impact Hydropower Institute, that we received our recertification. And in particular, I just wanted to highlight all of our environmental work in the tail race and on the Chelan River really contributed to our recertification. We have had several years of successful habitat utilization on the record now. As you all know, that prior to relicensing the project in 2006, the river was dry for 9 months of the year for the previous 83 years and now has year-round flows, which contribute to an enhanced aquatic system. And we had our engineers and fish biologists work closely with federal and state environmental agencies and tribal representatives to basically make this really excellent spawning and rearing habitat for fish. So you may also remember that the project received the 2010 Outstanding Stewards of America's Waters Award from the National Hydropower Association for Recreation, Environment, and Historic Enhancement. And this was also for our Chelan River habitat enhancements. So the certification will run through September of 2022. Any questions? And I just actually wanted to make a comment that Jeff Osborne was very helpful in reviewing the application. I pulled together a lot of it myself, but needed the expertise of our natural resource folks. And Michelle Smith as well was helpful in reviewing.
That's great. Commissioners, any questions, comments? That's a real showcase up there. I will tell you that that's a beautifully job done. Really,
we're very pleased to have that third party kind of affirmation and highlight of the fact that we can generate clean, renewable, carbon-free power and also protect our fish resources.
Right. Yes, Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah, so that's great news. I think it'd be very important to get that information, get that out there, publicize that, get it in the community. I have lots of people drive up there. You know, you can drive up and duck under the fence and peek over and see what we've done, and you can't see anything really by looking at it. You can't see the you know, the effects and how it's impacting the fish. And so, you know, there are a lot of comments about, well, that's a $12 million fish hotel that, you know, I mean, you get these kind of comments. So I would, Jeff, sorry about that.
Oh, we will do what we can on that point, and definitely it has received national recognition at this point, at least in two different ways, for the for NHA and now the Low Impact Hydropower Institute. And this process differed from how we were recognized in the past because of the really, really rigorous public process and rigorous analysis that we went through from all the board members, and they assigned a specific reviewer to our project, and we spent a lot of time on the phone explaining the mm-hmm. details. So, yeah. And they were very impressed.
Good. So when this comes up for recertification in 2022. So when this continues to come up for recertification, can we continue to fall back on the results that we get because of this particular project?
We have to submit annual compliance reports, and then we will be able to rely on what we've done. But well, every time this project will come up for recertification, we'll do an analysis as to whether it would make sense to get it recertified. Likely we'll do that. We'll have to see kind of when that comes around, because it's pretty a resource intense process, but it's a really nice acknowledgement for the success of the project as well.
So we don't have to come up with new innovative ways to deal with fish passage in order to continue to be recertified.
No, we just have to be able to show that we're meeting all of their criteria, and they have some pretty strict criteria in terms of, you know, water, fish, recreation, and cultural resources. So as long as we will have to give them an update on that topic in particular. But we have just a few compliance items that they're going to want to make sure that we remain in compliance with the license and with everything that we've basically let them know. What we've got going at the project. We'll need to give them any updates if something changes. But based on how the project operates now, we're certified.
Thank you. I know a lot more today than I did coming in.
So, Suzanne, their criteria might change in the future, and that might cause us to take a detour in terms of how we would, what steps we would take to continue to be certified?
Correct. They had not previously changed the certification since 2006. Yeah. And it was, you know, we had to report a lot of information, but this was we probably went from a, you know, 12-page kind of a matrix type of submission to a 40-page application.
This is the size of the application, and it was previously a 4 or 5-page
I see. Okay.
So Suzanne did a tremendous job pulling a lot of information together to have the baseline for this. I just kind of filled in around the edges, but you know, the expectation is we have a wonderful project going there. We have fish using it, Chinook, steelhead, resident fish, and we can continue to point to that as a tremendous success throughout the life of the license, as a tremendous mitigation as well as enhancement for the project.
Good. Great. Good.
Yes. On a side note, I just wanted to say thank you for something. You provide us a lot of reading material on an ongoing basis, and I think it's important for you to know that really helps me.
Oh, thank you. I like to hear that.
For example, just the article the last time of how New York and California are competing in the climate race and the impacts and how that's vastly different and how they're using hydro. I thought it was fascinating, and I just want to tell you, you probably don't hear from us on that information, but it is read and it is appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Suzanne, out loud for ahead of time for the work she's doing organizing my hill visits next week. So
you will be getting an update soon.
Okay.
We like to do things kind of at the last minute sometimes. So.
Yep, I do understand that completely. You've been doing that for several years, and it's really valuable.
We're going to stay on Lake Chelan and ask John Wozniacki to come up and talk about a recent application made to the Department of Commerce for qualification for incremental hydro treatment under I-937.
Hello, John Wasniewski with the Energy Planning and Trading Group. I'm here to let you know that incremental hydropower produced by the Chelan Hydro plant as a result of new turbines and generators that were installed in 2009 and 2010, that efficiency gain was accepted by the state of Washington and Oregon under the RPS standard as renewable energy. And so that helps us to meet the renewable portfolio standard requirement, as well as have additional RECs, renewable energy credits, which we can trade and monetize as a result of those efficiency gains. So pending any questions.
Just curious what percentage efficiency or what percentage meeting the RPS, how much would this in particular contribute to meeting that standard?
Sure. So in right now, the RPS standard or the target is defined as about 9% of our load, which comes out to be about 18 to 19 average megawatts. This the efficiency gain was about 5.4%, or about 2.5 average megawatts. So that's kind of how it compares to the total.
Yeah, thanks. That's helpful.
Sure.
Good. Commissioners, any other questions, comments?
Great. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last up, I want to invite Kim Craig to come up and talk about an event coming up here soon that we're going to work together with the group FWE on.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Kimberly Craig, part of the communications team, and I wanted to invite you to Hydro Power Appreciation Day this year, July 21st at the Seattle Sounders. We have a video that we've worked with our FWE Friends Foundation for Water and Energy Education on, and I'd like to show that to you. So I'll just follow up with hydro power. And there are tickets still available for that game. We'll have FWE and the supporting partners will be on the concourse to talk with folks about clean, renewable hydropower. And this is our second year teaming with Seattle sports teams. Last year's effort won a NHA OSA award for education and public outreach on hydropower. So we hope to see you there if you can possibly make it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
That's it for our manager items for today. We're ready to move to commission items.
Okay, commissioners. Commissioner item, I think we have a motion here. Would anyone?
Got other items too.
And other items, yes.
I just wanted to share with my fellow commissioners only Dennis could have known ahead of time what I was going to be going through the last couple of months. It's really busy being president of the association and doing other things on top of that. But what I wanted to share just now was last week I had the opportunity to go to Tri-Cities for this Legislative Energy Horizon Institute. There were 40 legislators from around the country, literally, and Canada. From Pennsylvania to Georgia to Quebec to Saskatchewan and all points in between. And I got a real grounding in Energy 101, which people may think I have, but like I told them there, I always thought electricity came from dams. And so I didn't know anything about gas and oil and a little bit about wind, a little bit about solar, but it was a real education. But a couple of things that I came away from that I just thought you might truly appreciate. I mentioned this to Steve and Gary at breakfast the other morning, is when you sight a transmission line over a barbed wire fence, you better protect that barbed wire fence, because the inductive power of transmission electrifies that fence and it kills cows. I did not know. A legislator from Kansas brought that up in the meeting, and the presenter said, absolutely, you have to ground that fence, even though there's no connection. That was one. The other aha moment was in battery storage, which Northwest Labs is working. They're doing a lot of research on batteries for not only for cars but for utilities. And the fact that most of you probably thought that electric cars had a big battery. Well, they don't. They have usually about 7,000 little lithium-ion batteries. And I see Steve shaking his head. Well, I didn't know that. But it's the, from soup to nuts, we learned a lot. I even got to do Legos exercise with Avista Utilities in creating an integrated resource plan, with each Lego representing a form of a resource, whether it be conservation, coal, gas, hydro, or whatever. So it was some really good hands-on activity and 14-hour days for 4 days in a row. So it was a good opportunity.
Long days.
It was.
Yes, Commissioner McKenna?
I have a couple of items. One is to correct something I said in the last meeting. I was in error that the Cascade School District, I thought, used the GCCM project method, and they used the design bid build method. They studied the GCCM, which we're looking at with our service center. So I was in error, and I just wanted to correct that. Also, secondly, I wanted to share that Gary and I took advantage of the Stimmelt offer to do a tour of their facility as they're preparing to build a new
warehouses.
No, the electrical
robots
substations. Oh. So anyway, when we took a most fascinating tour of that building, if you've never gone through it, one, be prepared to walk, get your steps in for the day, because they, Jay did a great job, and that guy's in shape. He walked us all over, and for a guy with a new knee and a new hip, there are two guys with new knees and hips, it was a job. It was a fascinating day to look at how they use electricity to run that robot out there. It was just an incredible day to think of robot that stacks and crates and palletizes and moves fruit down and keeps track of where it's at. And you go into this huge building, these robots are moving and picking up, and think of, I think it was 2 or 3 football fields.
Easy.
5 stories high, 32 rows in length, the full length of those fields, moving those palletized 7-8 foot high deals of fruit, and keep it all organized so that as they bring it out to the truck, there's only enough fruit being stored out at the truck or the platform to either load or take off on the trucks. So they're not, it's just enough fruit that's there. It's incredible how they're moving things. And, it was incredible.
Does that robot operate off electricity?
It does.
we asked that question.
And not only do they use a lot of electricity, but water. So they're involved with the city and the PUD on water usage. And it was a fascinating day.
One of the, if I might add, one of the fascinating comments and elements of this facility is the robots work 24/7. So even in the middle of night, they will identify pallets that maybe have been there longer than other fruit. So in the middle of the night, the robot will go down this particular row, up a couple of flights, find a particular pallet, and they will remove it and then take the new fruit that just came in and stack it in the back and take the pallet that has maybe been there a day or two and stack it in the front so that it will be one of the first ones to go out to the trucks. So the system is intelligent. And as a matter of fact, I think I heard the words artificial intelligence was being used in their software to make sure that the fruit was FIFO and that they were getting the best, freshest fruit out to their customers as possible. So it's a fascinating tour. I would encourage anyone who has the opportunity to certainly take it, and from the standpoint of the commissioners, to be able to see the power usage, which was one of my questions. As Commissioner McKenna mentioned, there is a new substation there to help power some of the activities, and I can see why, because the computers, of course, run on electricity, but very fascinating to see that automation. So it was a good tour. Thanks for bringing that up, Steve. Any other comments, commissioners? No? Okay, now we're on to a motion. So does anyone care to make a motion?
Sure. I would move to set a special meeting on September 30, 2019 at 10:30 a.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a board workshop.
Do we have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any comments?
Why are we starting at 10:30? I forget. Instead of 9 a.m.?
I'm just learning that there may be an opportunity to change that. But if we check on that, and maybe we'll hold this motion until right after lunch.
Okay. All right. We'll come back and visit the motion after lunch.
Well, if the rest of you would prefer that.
No, it's not a preference.
No, I think it had to do with a conflict with an internal staff meeting. So that's why I want to check on that.
Okay. Thanks.
On the time or the date?
On the time.
On the time. Yeah.
Okay. So we would postpone the decision, definitely, following the 1 o'clock start.
Yes.
Motion to table till the 1 o'clock
time? Yep.
Okay. So in motion, we'll bring this matter back up after we readjourn after 1 o'clock. Right? All right. Any other commission items? Nothing? Now we're on to follow-up of delegation items.
We had two from the last meeting, both of which have been completed. Discovery Center temporary closure PSA to the commissioners was sent out, and Eric had sent the decision evaluation criteria document to the commissioners as well. They were both completed on the day of the board meeting. We do have a couple others that have come up from the past in our parking lot that we've cleared out. Wanted to make sure that they're identified. First, Rebecca has worked with Peter Spadoni to arrange the tour of the Old Station campus. You heard about that. That was July 12th. And then you should have received an email from Mike Coleman and me regarding the shared radio capacity availability on the microwave system and looking at that. I believe that's it for today.
Yeah, okay. I thought Mike's explanation was really well done.
Yeah.
That was helpful.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. On to today's delegation.
We have two, that the clerk of the board will work with the president of the board on a budget revision for commissioner training, and that Eric will send the existing real estate delegation resolutions along with the proposed resolution to the board before the next board meeting.
That's it. Okay, and that's it. So we're at that point where we're looking for public comment. I don't see any public here. Okay, any matters of general business? Hearing none. We are adjourned until the 1 o'clock business session, at which time we will come back and take up matters.
And the tabled motion.
And the tabled motion, that's correct. Welcome to the July 15th, 2019 business session. Actually, we're beyond business session even. This is a deferred motion that we're coming back to discuss at this point. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices that you may have with you. We place great value on public input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item, please step forward to the microphone, state your name, your address, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. So, before we took our last break for lunch, we had a motion that we had tabled, and that we would come back and discuss that motion after lunch. So, commissioners.
I think I had an action item on that, and that was to check, and we are able to start that day at 9 if you would prefer that. So, we're good with starting at 9.
9? How about everybody else? That works fine.
Perfect. Yeah.
I mean, I know you're up at 4:30 a.m. also.
That's usually earlier.
9 a.m. Okay, thank you.
So would someone like to restate the motion then with the earlier start time?
Do we want to do a lesson in Robert's rules in this process? And because you'd have to take the motion off the table, then you'd have to move to amend the motion, and then go through that process. Or we can just agree that we want to start the meeting at 9 o'clock and make a motion to that effect.
I defer to my fellow commissioners as to how we would like to proceed on this.
Yeah, I think it would too.
All right, but very good. So, Randy, you made the motion.
I'm good with I would restate my motion to say that we start that. Where the heck is it? There it is. Move to ignore the tabled motion and to set a special meeting on September 30, 2019 at 9 a.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a board workshop.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. There are no noes, so ayes have it.
Okay, and I think we are also ready to bring back item 12. This was the resolution approving the purchase and sale agreement with the Nevio and Elizabeth Tontini Living Trust for the purchase of real property and authorizing the general manager or his designee to complete the transaction. We had wanted to wait to see if there's any public comment. We do not have any public present to offer comment.
Okay. So at this time, then, we would entertain that approval of the regular agenda with item 12 attached specifically.
I move that we accept Resolution 12 as presented.
Second.
Second. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The ayes have it.
Great. And with that, we are done with the full agenda, and we are ready for executive session. Staff would like to recommend 120 minutes for executive session.
All right. So it is 1:05. We will be going into executive session for roughly 2 hours. And
for the purposes stated.
Well, thank you.
Commissioner Bia.
I appreciate that. To discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation, which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by the RCW.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're coming out of executive session. It is July 15th, 2019. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.